You'll find it very helpful to have your Bible open at 1 Samuel 23. I want us to notice the breadth of God's providence. By providence, we mean the activity of God in his world in such a way that all of his holy will and purpose comes to pass, and that his people know that he indeed is God and is good and is with them, and that ultimately it will all be to his glory and praise. I want to just highlight three things from that passage that we read. And the first covers the first section of that chapter. And then we'll look at two other things. The breadth of God's providence, it's just everywhere as we look at this portion in David's life. David, of course, has been through quite a sticky spiritual patch. But now we see very much that he's in a spiritually healthy place, and he's acting as a leader over a few hundred of the Lord's people. Most of us would think 600 people to be in charge of is more than enough responsibility. It is, of course, just a tiny, tiny percentage of the people of Israel. But nevertheless, David now is really beginning to show himself once more to be walking closely with the Lord, having spiritual health and vitality that seem to have disappeared for a chapter or two. And we learn much, I think, for our own selves from this chapter this evening. I want us to see, first of all, that David seeks God. That's very important. David seeks God. There's a few place names here that might not be that familiar to us. So we've got a map that you can have a look at. And there's this place that's come under attack. Keilah, there it is, just in the middle. You'll see David's in the cave at Adullam. And so you can see Keilah is actually very close. It's only a stone's throw away, really, which is probably okay for someone like David, I guess. But, So it's quite close. And then down here, you've got the areas of Ziph and Maon, and then En-Gedi, which are all mentioned in the reading. And so you've got Bethlehem and Jerusalem up at the top there. Jerusalem at this stage really doesn't play much role at all in the life of Israel, other than being another town. It will be David who eventually makes Jerusalem their capital city, but it isn't at the moment. And so that's the area where this is all taking place. Right down in the south, of course, when we get to the Gospels, all the action's taking place right up in the north in Galilee. But that's where all of this action is taking place. The Dead Sea, as you can see there, the River Jordan, flowing down into it from Galilee up in the north. So that's roughly the geography of what's happening here. So David's right in the middle of that map as 1 Samuel 23 begins. And then as we go through the chapter, he moves down south into this lower area around Ziph and Maon and En-Gedi, a very wilderness area. So that's where it's all taking place. And we see in verse 1 that news comes to David that the nearby town of Keilah is under attack and needs help. The Philistines are attacking. They would send out raiding parties. They were mostly just after food. They would take their crops, they would take their cattle and livestock, they would send in a raiding party, they'd kill whoever needed to be killed in order that they could get hold of those goods, and then they'd disappear off with them. That was their main format of fighting. And there's a raiding party attacking Keilah. Should David take his men to help? Well, verse 2, we see a very encouraging sign in David. He got straight down onto his knees and he prayed to the Lord. Should he take these men down to help save Keilah from attack? and he inquires of God. And God replies. So we see, don't we, David now is in a much healthier spiritual state. He's communing with God. He's in fellowship with the Lord again. That's a great place to be, isn't it? I trust that's your experience this evening, that you're in fellowship with God and communing with him. And God says, yes, you go down and see if you can help out there. And then we see that David obviously tells his men that that's what they're going to do. And we see there in verse 3 that actually they're terrified at the thought. And they say to David, look, we're frightened enough here. Never mind going to fight the Philistines. We're struggling to cope with this situation. And you want us to go there and face the Philistines? No way. We're just not up to that. There's no way we can do it. Now, if I was David, or if you were David, I wonder how we'd respond when his men come back with such a response. I suppose some of us might get quite angry with them, because David's absolutely clear and certain in his own mind about the course of action that they need to take. After all, he's inquired of the Lord, and the Lord has said yes. And now his own men are wanting to stop him from doing what David knows God wants him to do. Maybe we could understand ourselves getting really angry. Maybe some of us can imagine ourselves storming off in a huff. Maybe some of us can imagine turning round and bullying them into submission. You remember who I am. I've inquired of the Lord. Who do you think you are? You're going to do it. But David doesn't respond in any of those ways. That again is a mark of the spiritual health of the man. What does he do when at the very first hurdle he can't do what he knows the Lord wants him to do? Well, he just gets straight back onto his knees again. Now, isn't that a helpful practical lesson for us? That even though we know and are convinced of what is a correct course of action, there might be things that get in our way, obstacles or hurdles of whatever form that come and stop us. Well, David gives us a wonderful example. Just get back down on your knees again and take it to the Lord. It's simple, but we can be very slow to do it. But David is learning. He's really learning. He's had some hard lessons, but he's learning from them. And God is working in them. And it's a sign also, isn't it, that he actually has a real concern and care for these people. And he doesn't jump down their throats, as he might want to do. But he prays, not only for his own situation and not for the people down in Keilah, but he has this concern for his own men. He understands their concern. He understands their fear. He doesn't even try to sit down and reason with them. He doesn't even sit down and try and talk it through. See if I can win them around somehow. He takes it to the Lord. A really helpful lesson. Take it to the Lord. It's a very wise example that David gives us here. And having taken it to the Lord, we see that he gets a positive answer. Yes. Go. End of verse 4. I will deliver the Philistines into your hand. And now it would seem, we have to kind of, to some degree, join a few of the dots ourselves, perhaps in our own imaginations. David coming back to the Lord, his men can see and are aware that David has diligently sought the Lord in prayer. And David is able to come back to them and say, the Lord has assured me that we will have victory over the Philistines if we go down. Perhaps what we have here, it's not actually spoken as such, but perhaps there's an indication there that these men recognize this spiritual leadership in David. They recognize this man who has a heart after the Lord. And if David truly has sought the Lord, and we have no reason to doubt that he hasn't, then yes, we are persuaded. If God has said to us through David that we will gain the victory, then we'll go. And down they go. And in verse 5, it comes about just as God has promised. And the defeat is described as being with a mighty blow. You know, this wasn't four all at full time, goes into extra time, and it's still a draw, and then they just scrape through on penalties. It's a mighty blow. It's a decisive victory. Because we see the providence of God here. God is over his world. God is over his people. And of course, God knows what the outcome is going to be. Isn't that an encouragement for us as Christians when we face uncertain things? The Lord knows what the outcome is going to be because of the breadth of his providence in his world. And it comes about just as God had said. And David, the end of verse 5, saves the inhabitants of Keilah. Now in verses 7 to 8, Saul finds out where David is. And when he realizes that he's in Keilah, which is presumably a town that is walled and has a gate, that if David is inside the town, Saul can very easily come down and surround it, and David has no way of escape. He's got him cornered. And so Saul decides, right, this is my big chance now. Let's get down to Keilah and get that place surrounded, and we've got him. He's got no way of escape. But David calls for Abiathar the priest. Now Abiathar had arrived in verse 6. And it says that he's brought with him the ephod. Now you might not all know what an ephod is. So, well, I've got a picture to show you for one thing. On the left there, that's part of what we might call the priest's uniform when he was serving in the tabernacle. There were various things that the priest had to wear, but two of the items were the ephod and the breastplate. The breastplate is where you'd expect it to be. That's the big thing on his chest with the 12 stones set into it, one stone for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. But over his shoulders, holding up the breastplate, is the ephod. So that's the bit that go, the two straps that go over his shoulders. And on the top, you can see there are some stones. And on the right-hand side, there's a depiction there. You can read about this in Exodus 28, where the instructions are given. They were two onyx stones. And on one stone was inscribed the names of six of the tribes of Israel, and the other six tribes were inscribed on the second stone. So the priest has these two onyx stones on these straps with the 12 tribes of Israel inscribed, six on one shoulder, six on the other. And it's this ephod. Now, we're not told whether the breastplate was still attached to it. It might have been, but it's the ephod that's mentioned. That's the shoulder straps. And they've been brought. Now, if you remember, in the previous chapter, all the local priests had been killed by Doeg. They'd helped David, and Doeg, on Saul's behalf, slaughtered and put to death all the priests. One man's managed to escape and brought in his hand the ephod. So David takes hold of the ephod. David has great care to know that you can't just approach God any old how. There's no priests available to represent him. Now, of course, the priests act as mediators between the people and God. The priests take care of all the sacrifices in the tabernacle. Because as sinful men and women, we cannot approach God lest we die. But God has arranged for this priestly system whereby the priest acts as a mediator between sinful men and women and God. And in this case, it's the sinful men and women of Israel. Well, there's no priests available. But there is an ephod, and that acts as a symbol of priesthood. So David takes care to use at least what is available to him. And he takes hold of the ephod because he recognizes that actually it is necessary for us to have a mediator between us and God. So how privileged we are that when we gather, we don't need to have something that I have to wear or you have to hold, because we have that mediator in the Lord Jesus Christ. And we can approach the Lord openly and freely because of him. But so David is just acting in a reverent and careful way as he comes before the Lord his God. And he acknowledges this priestly role that is necessary between us and God. And he comes and he asks the Lord, and he says, "Will Saul come here to get me? And will the men of the city turn me over to him?" And God says, "Yes." Well, that's gratitude for you, isn't it? Here he is in Keilah. He's just saved them from the Philistines. And what do they do to say thank you very much? They're actually ready to turn him over to Saul. Probably because they think, well, the last thing we need to do is fall out with Saul. So we'll happily hand David over. Well, that's grace, isn't it? There can be very many disappointments for the Lord's people as we seek to walk obediently with him. You've probably known a few over the years. The key thing that we see from David is that at each stage as he goes through here, he keeps inquiring of the Lord. And he just keeps taking things back to the Lord. He just gets back down on his knees. And he's content to know that what he's doing, God would have him do. And so there's really important lessons that we can learn from this first part of the passage as we see it. David in action. God has given us means of prayer. God has given us his word, along with the counsel of other godly believers, so that we can come before him and seek his face, find out what he would have us do. And it's all in his word for us. But we need to take time. We need to make sure that we turn here and learn from David, because we have a God who has a wonderful breadth of his providence. He's over all things. And we see two amazing examples of God's providence at work as the chapter continues. The first thing I just want to highlight is in verse 14. We see David's enemy confounded by God. David's enemy confounded by God. David, from the Lord, realizes that if he stays in Keilah, Saul's going to come, the men of Keilah are going to turn him over. So he gets out of there. And it says at the beginning of verse 14, he's in the strongholds in the wilderness. He's just wandering around in the mountains in the wilderness of Ziph, that area in the middle of the map that we saw before. And it says, Saul sought him every day. Every single day. But God did not deliver him, that is David, into his, that is Saul, hand. God did not deliver David into Saul's hand. Saul is searching high and low. He's got his men out everywhere. Yet all of his efforts are coming to nothing. He's probably got his choicest spies, his elite soldiers, out looking, and they just can't find him. Why is that? Is it that David's particularly good at playing hide and seek? Well, he did get quite good at playing hide and seek, but that's not the reason why. If Saul does find David, it won't be because of Saul's clever cunning. The only way that he'll get his hand on David is if God delivers David to him. This little phrase lets us just peer for a moment into a vast truth the overarching providence of God in his world and in the affairs of all men. Why couldn't Saul find David? Answer, God wouldn't let him. God did not deliver David into Saul's hand. Because David's in God's hand, and Saul is in God's hand. If he wants to bring the two together, he will do. If he wants to keep them apart, he'll keep them apart. And nothing Saul does can do anything about it. And now is not the time for Saul to find David in God's economy. And so Saul doesn't find David. Isn't that encouraging to know that that is how God is at work in his world? And in our lives every day, as the Lord's people, God's providences are at work. For the most part, they're probably unseen by us, and for the most part, they're probably unknown to us. But working they are. And David's enemy is confounded by God. What a wonderful God we have. And what a wonderful protection David is enjoying at this point. Then the third thing I want you to note is that David's enemy is distracted by God. At verse 16, David meets up again with Jonathan. Jonathan, of course, is Saul's son, and they're bosom friends, and they've made several covenants with one another in their friendship together, and they meet up. And a real game of cat and mouse with Saul takes place in the wilderness from verses 19 through to verse 25. Saul comes down from Gibeah in the north, while David is keeping on the move in the wilderness around those towns of Ziph and Maon. That's real cat and mouse stuff. And then at verse 26, they're on a mountain, and Saul is slowly managing to get his men to circle around the mountain where David is. They really are closing in. Now, if you're at the top of a mountain, and your enemy are all around you at the bottom of the mountain, there really isn't any way out, is there? And Saul and his men only have to start making their way up that mountain. And of course, you know that mountains get narrower, well, most do, the higher you go. So as Saul's men start to make their way up that mountain, his men are going to get closer to one another. That ring around them is going to tighten and tighten and tighten until eventually you'll just have David on the summit of the mountain with nowhere to run. You can see that that's what's going to happen. But God intervenes. If you know anything about the history of World War II, you will know that towards the end of World War II, the armed forces of Nazi Germany were becoming increasingly stretched, and they were becoming increasingly thin on the ground. And there were quite a few occasions when their commanders had to make some difficult decisions. They would have some of their armed forces fighting down here on this front, but they were also being attacked over here on that front. And they didn't have the resources to fight in both places. So they have to make a decision. Which of those two do we least need? Which is the one that we most need to defend? And on a number of occasions, they would have to withdraw forces from one battlefront and lose that ground in order that they could defend that ground, because they thought, that is the one that really matters. We can afford to lose that. We can't afford to lose both. But we can afford to lose that one if we keep that one. And if you read your history books, you'll see that that kind of thing was going on quite a lot in World War II towards the end. And in fact, in many wars, you see army generals having to make those kinds of decisions as they begin to lose the fight. Perhaps even in World War II, we see the hand of God at work in the way we see it at work here in 1 Corinthians, 1 Samuel 23. Because it seems that Saul is really close to victory. It seems that David's all done. And out of nowhere, a messenger appears. It's a bit like, remember that children's story, Mr. Ben? And he used to go on these adventures. And then all of a sudden, bing, the shopkeeper would reappear. Time to go. Well, that's what happens. And all of a sudden, bing, a messenger appears. Saul, bit of a problem. The Philistines are attacking big time. Real problem. We need you. Saul has to make a choice. Do I pursue David or do I go and fight off the Philistines? Well, he has no choice. The Philistines have to take priority. And so he has to call back all of his men. We can only begin to imagine what was going on the inside of Saul, to know that he was that close. And sometimes God allows the enemy to get that close. But he withdraws. And David's enemy is distracted by God. There's an intervention that takes place. And David is spared. Do you remember, those of us who were here, what we read this morning in Psalm 91? He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High, and there's no doubt at the moment David is in that place, and he kept going back to the secret place. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In him I will trust. Surely he shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day. It's real, you see. It's real. And here's an example of it in David's life. God has this breadth of providence over all of his world. And he's with David, and he spares him. God confounds Saul's search in verse 14. He can't find him anywhere. And then when he does eventually find him and he's just got him cornered, the Philistines arrive. I wonder which officer in the Philistine army had any idea at all that their attack would save the life of the man that killed their champion Goliath. Which officer in the Philistine army had any idea at all that their attack would save the life of the man who one day will be Israel's king and who will put them to the sword again and again and again? God has his hand on David because he's anointed him for a very specific purpose that has yet to be fulfilled. And so he uses even the army of Philistia to preserve him. And Christian believers, if that's who you are this evening, you are God's anointed people too. And the promises of Psalm 91 are for you, just as they were for David. And God will employ any means he sees fit on your behalf while there is yet work for you to do for him. Because we have a God who has a breadth of providence in his world that we cannot even begin to imagine. And if God is for us, who can be against us?